Welcome to Business Watch. Well, it doesn't exactly dominate the news cycle, but South Africa's industrial policy has major ramifications for economic policy, for growth and job creation. Now, spelt out in a series of annual industrial policy action plans, the IPAPs, and now sector master plans, South Africa's industrial policy has been in place for roughly 15 years formally now. Instruments have been chosen to support the manufacturing sector in general, and certain other sectors have been prioritized and do receive additional support. Now, industrial policy is notoriously hard to pin down, but the numbers make for interesting reading. If you look at the fact that between 1960 and 1994, South Africa's GDP grew at an average of 3.17% per annum. From 1994 to 2007, our first year of the IPAP policy, GDP grew at 3.5%. And then from 2007 to 2020, it grew at 0.9%. If you cut off at the end of 2019 and remove COVID, it averages 1.8% over that period. Now, we know unemployment reached a low of 22.4% by the end of 2007, and it's currently at 34.5%, higher now than it's ever been. So I think it's fair to say that our industrial policy attempts haven't yielded the desired results so far. Well, Trade and Industrial Policy Strategies is an independent non-profit economic research institute that was established back in 1996 to support the development of economic policy, and tomorrow turns 25. So 25 years in, I think it's appropriate to ask, what is our industrial policy, what it's achieved, and what does the future hold? It's a great pleasure to be joined now by TIPS board member Tadiso Matona, who is the Secretary of Planning of the National Planning Commission inside the Presidency. He was the Chief Executive of ESCOM for a few months, from October of 2014 to May of 2015, before being ousted for Brian Malefi and what we know now in the State Capture Spaghetti Project. He was previously, from January 2011, the DG of Public Enterprises. Prior to that, DG of Trade and Industry from 2005 to 2010, so certainly a super bureaucrat, and Saul Levin, Executive Director of TIPS since 2014. So welcome, gents. Tadiso, congrats on the milestone as you reflect on the 25 years of TIPS. What really stands out for you at this time?
Thank you very much, Mike. I think what stands out for me is the fact that we have not made the headway that we envisaged when we embarked on the revamping of industrial policy in South Africa, as you referred to in the late 1990s, early 2000s, as it were. So not through lack of effort, but we really haven't really made the kind of impacts. And in fact, what we have seen, on the contrary, is the continuing decline of the industrial economy, manufacturing in particular. And we really pinned our hopes on manufacturing. Really has been the driver of industrialization and the growth of the economy. So there are some really hard lessons to be learned from that kind of performance, as it were. I don't think there's anything wrong as such with our plans and the approach we've taken. And it's an approach that said, well, let's not look out in a traditional sense of industrial policy, which is picking up winners, but let's take a wide transversal approach, because there's so much activity across the economy in different sectors. So it's hard to pick one sector against the other. So we had a broad approach. As it were, I think that remains correct in my view. And depending on the quality of your support, some of those sectors will pick up. And there are sectors that have responded very well to some of the initiatives we have undertaken. I want to isolate, although it's a bit of an outlier, the automotive in in industry, where South Africa, you know, is a marginal in a global context. We're a marginal producer, and if you look at some of the consolidation that has happened in the industry, I feared that we will lose this industry. But we retain the industry, and in fact, it's growing. Major investments on a yearly basis. We have major in investment. The industry is innovating quite significantly, as it were. And that industry, in fact, drives many other industries across the board in terms of the suppliers, you know, supply chain and the value chain of the industry. So to come back to your question, you know, what stands out is that we still have heavy lifting to do to really get the traction, you know, for manufacturing and industrialization as such. I can come back.
I think that's a great place to leave it off as an opening comment, Sidiso. And clearly, looking at an EU trade survey that was conducted recently, automotives, tyres, and various components are some of our biggest exports to the European Union, and certainly a success story. I suppose one can question the cost because it has been a heavily supported industry. But I want to come back to you, Saul, at this occasion of 25 years of TIPS, and looking back, clearly, as Sidiso said, you know, we haven't achieved what we had hoped to with our various iterations of industrial policy. We've moved through the IPAPs, which tended to focus a little bit more on incentives, where we're now moving towards the sector master plans, which is more about getting a holistic view of an entire industry and getting everyone to understand what the opportunities, risks and trade-offs are. What would you say are some of the cross-cutting issues at this juncture that we've learned so far in this transition from IPAP to master plan approach?
So, I mean, for us, the key role that we've played is some of that heavy lifting that needs to be done. So it's around the sector studies that need to be done, the research and the understanding of what's going on in the sector. So the role that TIPS has played, particularly on industrial policy, has been to go into some of that detail. And we've been quite involved in most of the master plans that DTRC has been running through the research side. I mean, we are a research institute. We do the dialogue and we try and have engagements and recognize that successful industrial policy requires agreement on evidence and it requires the players to sit around a table and agree on a strategy, a way forward, and how government is going to work with industry and labor to get the desired objectives. We have seen some specific challenges. I think one of the big challenges, particularly in the 2010 decade, was that, you know, we still are a mining dependent economy in so many respects. And, you know, the success of the automotive industry, I think, has been phenomenal despite our quite heavy reliance on mining across the economy. And it's as a driver of so many other sectors. You know, it's the employment and the economies around employment that generates around that, but it's also the manufacturing that is required to support the mining industry and the incomes that are earned. During the 2010s, there was the end of the commodity boom. South Africa as a country didn't generate as much wealth from its mining sector. We see the turnaround now in recent times, and you know the benefits of that for the fiscus have been phenomenal. So, I mean, there are difficulties in trying to do industrial policy in a constrained environment, and we hope that our research has contributed to a better understanding of the challenges. We do quarterly bulletins that try and unpack what's going on in the economy, try to interpret it. South Africa is very fortunate to have a Stats South Africa that does really phenomenal work. We do take them on every now and again and raise concerns, but they prepare to engage. And you know, our latest issue was with the employment data. They'd gone for you know, a telephonic survey during COVID, and there were concerns with that, and they've responded. They're now doing the in-person surveys again, and we're seeing different outcomes from the employment data. So we do see the important role of what we do as enabling industrial policy, but industrial policy is difficult. It's not easy to get right. The shift for me from RPAP to master plans, I think, has been really important from our perspective, where, you know, the key essence of the master plans is to really drive the engagement between industry and business. And I think RPAP lacked a bit of that. RPAP certainly was very useful in understanding the sectors, understanding the constraints, and putting together action items to try and remove the blockages. But what the master plans have done for me, raise it to another level, where it's quite important to have that engagement and agree on that vision and work collaboratively between government and industry in order to remove the blockages and to get the growth that we need.
And I'll come back to the master plans to pick up on the motor industry, which has been a standout success to diesel. I suppose the question is, at what cost? If you look at National Treasury, it calculated the cost of support at approximately $211 billion between 1995 and 2012. Since then, the support has obviously increased significantly. The last figure I've seen here from Treasury in 2018 was support of 27 billion rand. Now, that figure is obviously tax foregone and certainly dwarfs support for the entire manufacturing industry outside of the automotive sector. So the critique has always been, are we getting sufficient return on that tax foregone in terms of jobs created and industrialization?
On balance, I think we do. And I guess it's a question of what kind of methodology do you use to determine the cost and benefit. You know, I've referred to the value chain. If you look at the value chain, at the last count, I think that to produce a unit of automotive requires about 12,000 different components, as it were, and around the industry is an ecosystem of component manufacturer and a fair amount of depth, you know, in terms of value add in the sector that one can't discount as it were. I would imagine that if the industry, if we were to lose the industry, and if it were to pack up and go, it would have severe consequences for the economy. So I think a narrow monetary approach would be a limited view. I think the emphasis right now is how do we actually deepen that ecosystem, particularly in terms of the components, and how do we localize. You know, there are certain things which probably we don't have a capacity for that, but there are thousands and thousands, you know, of componentry that we can manufacture, and the emphasis in the current support scheme is to incentivize the industry to actually invest in deepening local manufacturing of their requirements. And what COVID has done is in fact to affirm that. Because what COVID did is to disrupt supply chains and send a message that localize as much as possible, in localizing, take a regional view. We see that a number of African countries are developing the industry for themselves, and that there are enormous opportunities for cooperation in that regard rather than competition.
On that point, the localization, I think, makes absolute sense. If you say, for example, in the renewable industry, going to be having a 5 gigawatt per year annual rollout, to see how much of that you can actually localize competitively in an environment where China, we know, has got an arm lock on so many of these core value chains and components. But my concern is getting the balance right here. And Saul, your thoughts on the urgency with which we need to move to get, say, our locomotives rolling again, to unblock infrastructural bottlenecks around Transnet, to get the broader economy going and the benefits of that, the same with energy and new megawatts onto the grid, balancing that with the need to localize, which can be a constraint initially while you're building capacity in the industry. Are we getting that balance right? Because the Trade and Industry Minister was at an event this week saying he potentially needs to relook at some of those localization requirements in terms of bid window 5.
Yes, I mean, we definitely need to understand what we can make locally and what we need to import. So the challenge with sometimes using quite a blunt instrument of saying everything must be, you know, in a particular product must be locally made, when some of those products aren't done locally, you need a depth of understanding. What goes into the locomotive? What parts are we doing locally? What needs to be imported that we just don't have the capabilities? But a progressive view of saying, you know, we need to increasingly build our capacity towards more and more local capabilities is really important, so that we don't get stuck and we don't say, okay, fine, we can just import it. Because, you know, one of the lessons from the automotive industry and why it's such an important industry is that it's built domestic industrial capacity, where you have firms that are globally competitive. They can, some of their componentry can also be used in the locomotive industry. Mm-hmm. And we can see that there's a spillover from that industry into another industry. So, and also there's a range of plastic products. There's a whole range of leather products that come out of our capabilities that we have, in that automotive industry. So it's not just about, you know, the support to one particular industry. It's about saying, how do we broaden our industrial base and then increasingly build more capacity over time? And so industrial policy can't be a static thing. I think what we've seen is that it does need to be something we continually evolving. We have to be nimble. We have to be adaptive. We need to say, okay, this is not particularly working particularly well. But, you know, it doesn't mean that we need, so we can't be rigid and say, okay, everything needs to be localized on this particular supply chain. But we can say, you know, 60%, let's look at the products. Let's see what can be done, and then grow it over time as we build more capacity and capabilities. One of the other really important things that we need to start getting our head around is how critical services are, particularly professional services. You know, it's something that we've seen is a difficult fit in industrial policy, because people like that stuff that's made, but it really is a future area of growth. We've got a lot of capabilities on the software development side, on programming, on providing engineering services. We export those services often to the rest of the continent.
Yeah.
So we've got a lot of areas that we have strong capabilities in. And increasingly, even our manufacturing sector requires those services in order to function optimally. Mm-hmm. You know, when we've engaged with some of the automotive companies, their IT departments are growing exponentially, because a lot of the welds are now being done by robots. So you need, you know, the programmers and the controllers who are, you know, are in a service industry. So these are some of the changes that we need to continually explore and understand as the globe changes, as technology changes. Mm. And from our perspective, it's useful to have the research to better understand these changes and, you know, feeding it back into, you know, broader governments, particularly DTR, but not only DTR, so that there's a better appreciation of what's going on inside the economy.
Yeah, that evidence-based approach is certainly critically important. And business process outsourcing, we were ranked number one in the world. It's really a strength. So very encouraging to hear that this is being thought of in terms of our broader industrial policy. It's often put to me, Tadisa, when I chat to executives in various industrial sectors, be it steel and engineering, manufacturing broadly, mining, that we have a competitiveness problem. That, you know, things like preferential procurement, our BEE laws, localization, electricity, ports and rail, all of these conspire to hamper our global competitiveness. And so what we're seeing with the master plans is industries coming and asking for protection, but ultimately that should be a temporary shield, not a permanent protection. How do we deal with the underlying drivers that I've just listed, that often executives put forward to me as a hindrance on our competitiveness?
I think that a distinctive change, I think that the master plans are introducing is precisely to get, you know, all heads around the table and deal with those things as it were. Instead of trading critiques, you know, from each other's platforms, as it were, you know, where you know the industry kind of, you know, complains to the public, when in fact actually, you know, what we need is to sit together, listen to the problems, and find solutions to together. So in that sense, I think the master plans have moved away from this state centric or government centric approach, where we pronounce requirements, policy requirements, BEE, and wait upon the industry to comply. I don't think anybody, you know, has any difficulty with the need for transformation, the need for BEE, you know, the need for procurement to be used as an instrument, you know, for inclusion in the economy. But it's in the detail, it's in the nuts and bolts, and it's in the how we do it in a way that is meaningful, that does not create additional barriers or difficulties as it were. So knuckling down away from media headlines and finding solutions, I'm confident that there is an appetite for that, and it's really going to be dependent upon departments like DTI and other departments to be available, you know, to engage, to be accessible, and to be willing, you know, to take on board, you know, the feedback that they get and find solutions. Sometimes government can be very unresponsive, can be very insular, can be very inward looking. I think we need a more dynamic way of working together to overcome our problems, and that's really the strengths of the master plans as I see them.
Well, that's very encouraging to hear. And just this week, Saul, I was having a conversation with the head of the EU Chamber of Business, talking about various surveys that they've done, and wanting to bring in skilled expats to help transfer know-how and knowledge, which is such an important area, and it's one of those transversal areas that's been identified through the various master plans. We need to raise our skills base, but their frustration was that many of these businesses are family owned. They won't give up equity ownership, but they'd like some kind of equity equivalent in terms of transformation laws, and they agree with the spirit of it, but it's in those nuts and bolts that Tadisa was talking about that they are finding things a little bit difficult. So it's very encouraging to hear that government is open to where those nuts and bolts are retarding rather than promoting economic growth and therefore transformation. Just as we've got a couple of minutes to go, where do we go from here with the master plan? So what do you think is going to be seizing tips over the next few years?
So some of the big things that we're looking at, we've looked at some of the cross-cutting issues. We've done a lot of work on electricity, on the Transnet supply chain. And those things are affecting our competitiveness. So I think we mustn't underplay how big those issues are now. Previously, they were part of our competitive advantage. And the problems over the last decade have come home to roost, and it is impacting on our industries' ability to be competitive. So these are things that I think have been escalated, and the good thing about the current approach is that things are escalated and they are then able to be addressed, and there's a willingness to address them. So for us, we're quite positive about the direction things are taking. Sure, there's definitely problems, but there's a willingness and an engagement process and a process on how we gain and a plan around how we're going to fix them so that we can get those issues resolved. They're not quick issues, but they are definitely on the table. For us, some of the big issues going forward are definitely around the move to net zero and the reduction in fossil fuel usage. That's going to have major implications and ramifications. And we've been doing quite a lot of work around that the last 2-3 years, and it's definitely going to be occupying us going forward. It's going to impact on all of our industrial policy, how we think about electricity generation. Can it be done competitively using renewables when we have to shift our entire economy? And we are a very energy-intensive economy, so it's going to be a challenge, and I think it's something that we definitely going to be doing a lot more work on it. The shift from liquid fuels to different types of energy sources on that front, new energy vehicles, hydrogen fuel cells, battery-operated vehicles, these are all big shifts that are going to be happening, and for us, it's something that we're getting our head around. The types of battery storage, you know, we've got lots of minerals that can be used for battery storage. How are we taking advantage of those opportunities are other areas that we've been looking at.
And the great examples of companies that are getting behind this, Orion Minerals in the Northern Cape springs to mind, and new industries springing up, and the potential here for green hydrogen around Saldanha, reviving old mothballed industries as well. But it is also recognizing that this is going to be difficult to shift such an energy-intensive economy such as South Africa's. Thank you very much, Saul Levine, for your time. Tadisa Matona as well, our guest today, as we ran the rule over industrial policy over the last 15 years. Yes, not what we had hoped as a country to achieve, but clearly not through a lack of effort and trying. And the master plans are now trying to bring all of those conversations around the table where we can stop the lobbying and actually start moving forward to help grow the South African economy. You're watching Business Watch. We'll be right back.